I'll call the meeting to order, and we're going to hear a number of bills today. And the first one up is Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think first up, I just want to move House File 2841 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, I think is where it's,
right.
Where it's going. Good. I am going to be brief and let my testifiers kind of talk about the ombudsman program, but this is a bill for the Office of Ombudsman for Long-Term Care, and I will let you, I will let them tell you kind of what they do specifically, but my understanding is that they are the much-needed group that goes around the state, that has sites and folks all around the state that really help bridge the issues that we may have in our long-term care facilities and long-term care in general. They are a needed agency that helps us resolve issues before they get to kind of some of the catastrophic things that we have seen in our nursing facilities, and they also do great work. They have a volunteer network that is extensive, and they wouldn't be able to do their work without the volunteer network and volunteer coordinators if you think about how large our state is and how many facilities we have. So this is an appropriation of $200,000 that will help to expand the volunteer program. Obviously, there's leverage with that if folks are volunteers, and as our workforce is aging and headed towards retirement and some towards receiving some sort of long-term care, this is a much-needed agency and appropriation. So with that.
Thanks. Good afternoon. I'm sorry. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of committee. First of all, I just want to say thank you for listening to us. I know it's a very stressful time. Can you hear me? Okay, now I'm closer.
Yes, and could you please state your name for the tape?
Yes, I will do that again. My name is Deb Holtz. I am the state ombudsman for long-term care. And as Representative Hayden briefly discussed, our office serves anyone who has a complaint or concern regarding their long-term care, whether that's in a nursing home, assisted living setting, or even in their home if they're getting home care. Today, I want to simply plant a seed of an idea that might grow to a viable option when we have a healthier state budget. And I do believe that will eventually happen. Our office is seeing more and more seniors every day, and the issues that we get calls about range all the way from a senior who is at risk of financial exploitation, typically from a loved one, like a grandchild, somebody desperately needing their call light answered in an understaffed nursing facility before they soil themselves, or receiving an eviction notice in an assisted living setting. We think we can serve thousands more people in a creative, efficient, effective manner with our volunteers, also by changing their focus. We want to go from friendly visitors to volunteer advocates, volunteer ombudsmen in a sense. At the current time, regional ombudsmen just work with volunteers as they have time because their caseloads are so large. But we want to improve that focus. We want to recruit and train people to focus more on the idea that all of us has a responsibility to each other. For example, you and I have a responsibility to our neighbors. If we drive home and we see that the mail hasn't been picked up for a couple days, we have a responsibility to follow up, to knock on that door, or to find out what's going on. We have a responsibility if we don't see the shades pulled up for a couple days, just to follow up. What we want to do is tap some of that community resource and local issues to really look out for each other. We know we can do this by responding to more senior calls and also in different cultural communities. For example, a 90-year-old Hmong elder who lives at home, receives home care, might not call a government number if he has a problem with his home care. But we think he might tell a community volunteer who might be his neighbor, friend, or just a trusted member of his community. We think that we can do things differently and reach people in a different community sense. Again, we know this isn't the right year to make the request. We just want to plant the idea and hopefully see it grow in the future. I'm going to turn my voice over to a board member, and then I'm happy to answer any questions for you. Tracy? Chairman Huntley and committee members, thank you for letting me speak in support of this bill authorizing the expansion of the volunteer ombudsman program. My name is Tracy Keebler, and I am the chair of the Public Policy Committee for the Minnesota Board on Aging. For the past two legislative sessions, it has been the board's number one priority to increase protection and advocacy services for vulnerable seniors by supporting the work done by the Ombudsman Office. I would like to share a personal story about why I so strongly support this bill. My 92-year-old friend was living in a very nice assisted living facility. And at that particular facility, every night when he went to bed, a staff person went around and set a flag on his door so that they would know when that door opened the next morning that he was alive and that he had gone in and out of his room at least one time in a 24-hour time period. Unfortunately, he went to lunch on a Thursday, and he was not seen again, and that flag did not fall again until staff opened the door on a Monday morning. So, and he was found lying on the floor in his apartment. And that 3 to 4 day lag where no one was checking on him cost my friend his life. And it didn't have to be that way. There is a simple answer. The simple answer would have been if the facility had just done their job, my friend would have been fine. But we know that in the real world, sometimes work doesn't get done. And for most of us, when we don't do our work, we don't get our jobs done, the task goes on the to-do list for tomorrow, and there's no harm done. But sometimes when you're a care provider, there are serious consequences. And that's why we have an Office of the Ombudsman for Long-Term Care. That office has demonstrated that what we have proposed in this bill will work. They did a small study, and they trained 20 volunteer advocates in the manner proposed by this bill. And what they found in that study was that these advocates not only help the residents work through their problems or concerns, but they also work with the residents and educate them on how to advocate for themselves. Once someone has developed the confidence to be an advocate for themselves, it is a small step for that person to take to now become an advocate and watch out for their friends and for their neighbors. And they do this. The program that we're proposing has a cascading effect. Not only does it aim to train these 100 to 200 individuals throughout the state to act as the eyes and the ears for the Ombudsman Office, but they in turn empower residents to be aware and watch out for each other. All the members of the Board on Aging, all of us recognize that you have a very difficult job this year dealing with the state budget, but this bill that we have crafted is creative as it relies on community volunteers and empowered individuals and not paid staff to be the eyes and the ears for each other's care and well-being. We know that there is not enough money in any state budget to hire enough ombudsmen to be everywhere in every long-term care setting to ensure that tragedies like what happened to my friend won't happen again. But a volunteer ombudsman at a site or a dedicated volunteer working at a site or neighbors watching out for each other, that could have made all the difference in the world for my friend. I recognize, everyone knows that we're at this critical time where we've got this burgeoning, aging demographic. We've got an economy that is putting a lot of pressure, financial pressure on families, and that pressure is building and the calls to the Ombudsman Office are increasing. This bill is not perfect. However, state law requires that we provide ombudsman services of dispute resolution, advocacy, and protection in all settings where long-term care is received. I believe that this bill is a minimum first step in meeting our objectives. This bill is creative, it is a financially responsible bill, and most importantly, it's doable. I respectfully request your support of this bill.
Any questions? Representative Pepper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This seems like a fine proposal, but I'm wondering how we're going to expand this program when we're in a budget deficit. And so I guess this question is actually for you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering when we've seen a partial list of the budget targets, and it came to something like $312 million, but there wasn't health care or education listed, and I'm wondering when we might be able to expect a plan of reforms and whatnot to work our way towards.
Our Pollock and Walls and I have come up with three different proposals that I think we can share with you shortly that cut the 330, 250, and 200 million.
Those are the three different choices?
Yeah. And some of those proposals will have revenues with them. Actually, we're if the federal government passes health care reform this week, it will drastically change our budget. So, and my understanding is they are going to do something this weekend. It'll either be passed or they'll give up on it. In addition to that, there's the federal health the stimulus. There's a jobs bill that they're going to do right after the health care bill. That has what the governor's already put in his budget, the $410 million for the extension of the stimulus package. So that will probably be done next week as well, but I can get you a list of potential cuts later in the week. And then the deadline for our committee is kind of up in the air because of the federal reform. So I'm not quite sure what our final deadline is going to be. Yeah, Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Chair Huntley. The federal bill, could you talk about a little bit about what that would mean for, if it passes, what that might look like for our purposes?
Well, in terms of the budget, the federal reform bill, as it is in the Senate right now, in which the Senate bill is in the House, and you know, they could get rid of this by reconciliation. I don't know what will happen, but they there is 12 or 13 states, I can't remember which, Minnesota happens to be one of them, will be allowed to start the Medicaid expansion to adults without kids right away, April 1st. And so that would take care of our, basically take care of half of our GAMC problem because the feds will pay half. So if we were to go to 75% of poverty, that would take care of a big chunk of our problem with GAMC. About $250 million, we would still have to pay $250. Where I find that, I don't know. And so that's in that bill. And then, there's a jobs bill that has the extension of the stimulus for 6 months. And that's in the governor's budget. He had budgeted $380 million out of that one.
Thank you.
So, yes, we do have shortages. Yes. If we're lucky, they won't be as bad as we think they are. Yes, this does spend money, it'll be laid over for possible inclusion in the bill. And we will see what we can do when we balance the budget. But I had a question for Ms. Keebler. So you also oversee assisted living, or Ms. Holford or Ms. Keebler?
We do. Because of the federal mandate requires that we oversee and listen to any concerns coming from nursing facilities and board and care facilities. Because of our state mandate, which was enacted in the late 90s, we're also responsible for any long-term care delivered in home and community-based settings. So that includes assisted living settings. It would include your own home if you or your wife would need home care. We're also responsible for Medicare beneficiaries if they have questions about hospital admissions or discharges. So it's a pretty large number. Yeah.
Thank you. Any other questions? Well, I don't see any. So Representative Hayden renews his motion that House File 2841 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Liebling, House File 3246. Representative Liebling.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Chair and members, House File 3246 is a pilot project to allow counties to experiment with, for lack of a better word, different ways of providing chemical dependency services. And we had a bill in the last session that had the counties and DHS working together on this project. They've had some very productive work together. They've come up with a proposal, and basically this bill allows implementation of that proposal. And having said that, I will turn it over to my testifier.
Chairman Huntley, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Brupp. I am a division manager in Washington County, and I have oversight and manage the chemical health services in the county. Thank you for the opportunity to come here today and address you. In my testimony today, in addition to speaking on behalf of Washington County, I am also representing the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators. Thank you to Representative Liebling and the other authors for sponsoring House File 3246. This bill authorizes the Department of Human Services and participating pilot counties to continue to work in partnership to refine and implement the pilot project initiated under Law 2009, Chapter 679, Article 7, Section 26. The purpose of this project is to take a portion of the consolidated fund, the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund that most of us refer to as the CCDTF fund, and take a portion of those dollars that have been used for traditional treatment services and use it as a pilot to see for a certain subset of the population that we commonly refer to either as treatment repeaters or chronics, and see if we can have some more successful outcomes if we develop some alternative services. These are individuals who have usually had multiple treatment episodes. I think you have a handout. I'm certain that you have it in black and white. Not in this pretty color. So what I want to draw your attention to is you have an oblong circle, and that circle is what we really think of today as the treatment services for chemical dependency. And if you look down here at all these boxes on the bottom, the seven boxes on the right are the new services that we would like to provide as part of the pilot project. Those services include a navigation service, peer support, housing support, a rent subsidy for up to 3 months, supported employment, and independent living skills. The system's navigator role is to be able to identify what services these people need in a broader perspective than we currently see in the system. But usually people who are treatment repeaters have a multitude of needs across systems. They have medical needs, they generally have a poor housing and employment history, they may no longer have family support. And so the navigator's job is to try and help that person access systems, whether it's a mental health system, whether it's a rental system, in order to, after treatment, be able to stabilize their lives and hopefully be more successful at maintaining sobriety. The outcomes for this project that we will be tracking and analyzing over time to see if we are successful are also listed on the bottom of this handout. The financing aspect of the bill is as follows. There will be no increase in state expenditures. We're really looking to use the same dollars in a different way to see if we can be more successful with this population. The bill allows the commissioner to restructure payments to pilot counties. The current payment system is to set up to pay Rule 31 treatment providers. The pilot counties that are involved in this project are not Rule 31 providers. The counties are at risk for overspending. You may like that one. So that if we, as a result of our planning, overspend, we will be responsible. On the other hand, if we are underspent, we would like to be able to carry, underspent in the pilot, and in the pilot alone, we would like to be able to carry those funds over into the next year. That would help balance the underspending and overspending from 1 year to the next. And lastly, the commissioner will not enter into any agreements with the pilots that would jeopardize federal funding. And of course, everyone is in support of not jeopardizing funding anywhere as in these days. So I'd like to thank you for your support during the last session in passing the legislation that allowed us to plan for this pilot project. I am now here today to ask you for your support to allow the states and the counties to continue to work together to implement the project and to evaluate the outcomes of the project to see if there is a more responsible way to use county and state dollars. Thank you, and I stand for questions.
Mr. Rupp, the on the budget matter, this is money that's already appropriated, and is it affected by the governor's budget that takes a lot of money out of this fund?
I may have to ask the Department of Human Services to help me with that question.
Mm-hmm. Short answer, yes.
Okay, but well, let me get back to the first part. You're not requesting any additional money.
That is correct.
Okay. Representative Abler.
Well, and just to that question, if you had a smaller budget, you have to do the work anyway, but is this going to make it easier to do that if the governor's budget would go forward?
Ms. Rupp.
Thank you. That's a good question. Part of what this project is all about is trying to figure out with this particular population that we continue to send to treatment repeatedly, can we actually save dollars and whose dollars? It may be that we save detox dollars. It may be that we send jail. We save money for jails. But is there a tax savings as a result of working with this particular group of people differently? That's what's difficult about answering your question, is that I think we will save dollars. I cannot say confidently whose.
Representative Slawick.
Mr. Chair, both Representative Bunner and I looked at your name in Washington County, and you probably know we both represent Washington County.
Yes, I do.
So we're just wondering if Washington County will be a good model for this program. I guess you can't guarantee that, right?
I think it would be a wonderful model for this program.
We'd be able to hopefully, yes, use the dollars. I think it would be, it seems like a very good bill to me. Yeah, thank you.
Representative Thiessen.
Thanks. So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So on that budget question, so when you say you're going to use the same amount of money to do this work with the Navigator, is that including the money that you'd be spending on housing support and the money you'd be spending on support employment, which are in different budget areas, or would that be additional spending there? I mean, saving money maybe in the long term, but are there outside, you know, you're taking these, the drug treatment funds. Mm-hmm. To do this work, but is it going to cover all the costs? Like if you send someone to housing and you find them, or are we going to be spending more there?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the part of the Navigator's job is trying to help this individual access the service they need that may already exist in the system. So, for example, we already have a mental health system, and many of these people, over 50% of these people who get chemical dependency treatment, have a need for some kind of mental health system service. And so what we would be doing is accessing for people that there is already a service available for them that they don't know about. And there are some of these services that we have leveraging those dollars that already exist. And there are some of these services that are new that actually we will be using the consolidated fund to pay for.
And I guess my question, Mr. Chair, is exactly on that point. So, and I think this is absolutely the direction we need to go. This makes all the sense in the world to me. But as we think about the budget, if you're sending more people to access housing services, we'll be spending more money in housing. Am I understanding that correctly? I just want to get the full budget picture of this.
Representative, yes, we will be spending some money in housing. What we have done, though, in analyzing the numbers is that we took a look at the people that we were spending the most money on, and we were looking at if we spend those same dollars differently. That's how we're doing our budgets. If we spend the same amount of dollars that we were using for these people in treatment and we use them for these types of services, in the long run, will we have better outcomes?
Right.
Representative.
And Mr. Chair, so when you say the county is going to bear the risk of excess spending, mm-hmm. is it just for the treatment spending, or is it for, because all these are county-based services. So any of these that actually have, like the housing, there might be a state flow of money into that, but you're not expecting that the state's going to be spending more money on housing. You would pick up the tab at a county?
Representative, that is correct.
Okay. All right.
Okay. And next is Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. I'm understanding we're taking existing money and we're going to try to use it differently. And we have some idea how we're going to use it differently, or we're just broadening the options or experimenting at this point. Help me understand what I understand the idea of trying not to spend more money, try to spend the same money better, but give me a little more detail on that.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we have identified specific services, these seven services that are listed here. We have identified that those are the services that we can use with these dollars. These people may need other things, but we can't use this fund for this. And if there's an existing stream of funding that they can access for these services, then we have to use that first. So this is the last resort for these people who are not eligible for this funding, these services somewhere else. But it is this pool of dollars. So for each one of these categories, we are trying to come up with a definition about what does a navigator mean, what does peer support mean. And for example, we can only pay for a rent subsidy up to 3 months because it's a transition into more permanent rental assistance. That certainly the fund couldn't afford to do rental assistance over a long period of time.
Okay, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Go ahead. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And probably one of the things I've seen lately in several bills has been this whole exemption from rulemaking. And once again, we have another bill here that just, I think the real purpose of administrative rulemaking was not just the overall policy, but the details and how it is implemented. And when you do it in this sort of way, the public has no knowledge, no ability to give input, nor do many other people as well who may have an interest in this. So it really bothers me that once again here in this particular bill, we are waiving administrative rule requirements. I really object to that. I think that's a very bad direction that we're going here. I think there is good policy in making rulemaking important. So you'd have to really work hard to convince me that this is so worthy that we're just going to wipe off all our rulemaking. But I would like you to see if there's some reasons why. I certainly want to always be open if there's some really, really good reason.
Well,
Mr. Chair and Representative, one of the things that I think is good about a pilot is that it's small. And so before you make rules that would apply, which is a very extensive process, that would apply across the state, you would really want to know, is this worthy? Is this something worth doing, and is it a good way to spend our tax dollars? That's why this really is. We have gone to 10 counties in a rural area, one metro county, to try and demonstrate, is this worth doing? Because it takes a long time in order to figure out when you do something on a statewide basis. And that's what I think a pilot project on a small scale to see if something is worthy of doing rulemaking is one of the ways that is good policy.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Usually if you are going to do that, then though you have a little more detail in your legislation. So that, there can be times when that is really good. And I've certainly had experience with that, but then usually the legislature also had more requirements in the actual bill to kind of lay it out there and give some of those parameters. So maybe you might want to consider working on that a little bit more. But I think the other thing is that we're a finance committee, and there's mention of money here, but am I maybe missing? Is there a fiscal note or... I mean, there's talk here of expending money, so maybe there's something.
The money's already appropriated.
Okay, so that's...
It's in this fund, and they're just going to change the way they spend it within that fund. So there's no additional appropriation. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So in this situation, we aren't carving out a set number of dollars for them to have flexibility within. They are kind of really open to all of that fund, and that's pretty broad. Whatever. I just have concerns about that, especially if we're going to exempt them from rules.
Actually, we are working on what it will be the limitations of how much can be carved out, because counties still have to provide treatment in the usual way for people who are eligible for the fund. And so it would be a disincentive for us to carve out too much money because we're at risk. That's one of the reasons that we are being very careful in looking at the data over the last 3 years about spending and spending for who.
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. I just wanted to put my two cents into this. You know, whenever we talk about regulation, there's always a sort of a tension between regulation and, you know, which, of course, is there for a reason, to provide safety and oversight and some control over what people do, whether it's in the private sector or the public sector, and the freedom to innovate and do things differently. And I think what we have here is we all know we're in a situation where we need to try to do things differently. And so while I can appreciate the concern, Representative Kiffmeyer, about wanting, you know, everything to be laid out here, I think that what we have here is a process between the counties and DHS, where DHS is absolutely involved and overseeing what happens here. But if we don't take a step to allow people to have some flexibility, we cannot innovate. You can't find out what will work if you don't, if you're just stuck to the old way. And that's what is being done here, and there's been a lot of good cooperation between the parties. Now, Mr. Chair, maybe this would be a good time to bring up that I have had some conversations with MARCH, which is the organization of alcohol. I don't know what the acronym stands for, but
Minnesota Association of Resources Recovery and Chemical Health.
Okay. Well, there we go. And they did. They have had some concerns about the bill, and I do have an oral amendment that I would like to move, which is basically just some comfort language for them. I don't think we are able to completely resolve the concerns, and I don't know if they'll want to testify to that, but we have had a good discussion about it, and I am comfortable with the way things are. I don't know if we're going to be able to have everybody be perfectly comfortable, but Mr. Chair, would this be a good moment for me to move the oral amendment?
Representative Gottwald, do you want to wait with your question? Yeah, okay. Go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then I would move an oral amendment on page on 2.28 of the bill. And after the comma, I would insert the following language. Except that any chemical health...
Just a minute.
Okay.
What line are you on?
Okay, I'm on line 2.28.
Yeah, there's no comma in that line.
Oh, I'm sorry. After the making a period into a comma.
Oh, okay. Oh.
And adding, except that any chemical dependency treatment funded through the health pilot project shall continue to be provided by a licensed Rule 31 treatment provider.
Yeah, could you repeat that?
So on line 2.28, the period becomes a comma, and we insert, except that any chemical dependency treatment funded through the pilot project shall continue to be provided by a licensed Rule 31 treatment provider. So this is just, as I said, comfort language that just assures that we're not trying to take treatment away from licensed providers. That would still be provided by licensed providers, the actual treatment. Should I say it a third time, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, do it.
Okay, one more time.
I think I got it, but...
Yes?
Go ahead, one more time.
Okay, one more time. Okay, line 2.28, the period becomes a comma, and we add, except that any chemical dependency treatment funded through the pilot project shall continue to be provided by licensed Rule 31 chemical, by licensed 31 treatment provider.
Well, let me try it here, though.
Okay.
After the period goes to a comma, that part I got. Except that any chemical dependency treatment funded through the pilot project shall
continue to be provided
by a Rule 31 treatment provider.
Well, except for the word licensed, by a licensed Rule 31 treatment provider.
Yep.
That's okay, the critical. That's the critical issue, that person still has to be licensed.
Yeah. Okay. Why don't we vote on the amendment? Do you have a question about the amendment? Okay, Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling, I think I understand what you're doing here, and I understand it's meant to be comfort language. Does this limit options? I mean, we're talking about a pilot project. One of the things I like about this bill is the fact that it's offering us an opportunity to look at chemical dependency treatment differently. Is this limiting our options?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think that it is. I think that as I'm understanding it, the actual chemical treatment services, it was never our intention to have that done by unlicensed persons. And I think Ms. Rupp can probably speak to that. But the issue is whether this navigator person, who is really a coordinator of services, needs to be a licensed chemical dependency provider, and there's been some disagreement about that, and where I'm coming down is that they don't. But we're not intending to have the actual treatment be by unlicensed people, and that's where the comfort is.
Ms. Rupp.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Representative is absolutely correct. Treatment should always be provided by licensed treatment providers and licensed chemical dependency professionals. I do want to point out, though, that licensed Rule 31 providers are for adults, and the amendment then excludes treatment providers for children, and so it may be that you would want to add that amendment.
Licensed chemical dependency treatment provider rather than specifying rule. Right.
That rule's on the
Okay. Okay. Mr. Chair, it sounds like I need to amend my oral amendment to take out the words Rule 31.
That would be correct.
Yeah.
So it would just be by a licensed...
by a licensed treatment provider.
Yeah. Okay, Representative Liebling has her amendment, and it's been corrected again. And is there any further discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the amendment is adopted. And did you have Representative Gottwald?
The only other question I have, Mr. Chair, is whether the department has any issues with this at all. I haven't heard of any, but I'm just wondering if they do, and if so, if they're here to address that.
Hi. I'm Carol Falkowski, Director of the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division at the Department of Human Services, and I've been working with this group since July. And I do have a couple points just of clarification so everybody knows exactly where this is. Will this save money? We don't know. That's why it's a pilot, and we estimate it's going to be a couple hundred people in the southern region and a couple hundred people in Washington County. So it's just allowing flexibility for the consolidated fund for that group of people for a period of 2 years, after which we'll assess whether money was saved or not. Secondly, is it going to produce better outcomes? I don't know, because that's why it's a pilot. That's why you do it. To have it characterized as a pilot that's treating chronics is, I think, a bit misleading, because in my world of addiction, a chronic is really looked at as someone who has decades of a history. And the criteria for being included in this pilot is only two treatments in the past 2 years and a mental health diagnosis. So it's really people who are very upstream. So therefore, I don't know if any of this is going to produce better outcomes. It's not really a chronic population. It's certainly treatment repeaters, but many people have multiple treatment episodes. And then finally, where it does represent a departure is that for the first time, the Consolidated Fund, which is the only stream of money designated in the state that treats a single disease, is this allows that to be used for other things for which there are already government streams. So it allows something for the treatment of the disease to be used for housing and peer support and family engagement and other things. And that really is an extreme departure from current practice. So those are my points of clarification. And to your point, Representative Huntley, about that the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund is currently facing, with the governor's proposal, reduction. And so this would mean that anything that stems from it, including this pilot, would have less money to work with. But the cap for the pilot is based on the past 3 years of consolidated fund expenditures.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so if I'm understanding you correctly, is the department on board with this?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you answered my other question, and that was about chronic inebriates.
Yes.
There's been a lot of discussion about that over the last few years. I know we've had some in my own district about chronic inebriate facilities, but wondered if this pilot project was going to look at that population as well. It sounds like it won't be.
Well, it will be if chronic inebriates happen to have had two treatment episodes in the past 2 years. You know, but it will also serve people whose first entry into the whole treatment system may be fairly recent. It doesn't go back to limit it to people with decades of treatment failures.
Okay, Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I think Representative Liebling answered the question that we're not waiving administrative rulemaking. We're waiving rules that exist today to allow this to go forward for this progress. And so, but I'm so you really think that in the two-year budget cycle, you're going to pay for housing and pay for independent living skills and rent subsidies and spend less money in your county than you would today?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, you know, again, that's a hope, you know, it's a pilot. So
and I guess my question is, the county's willing to take that risk that that's what's going to happen, and you're going to bear all the costs of that. There's going to be no state cost to housing and independent living and any of those things.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, that is our intent, and that's why we are carefully, every client that we accept in this pilot won't need rental assistance. Every client won't need peer support. So yes, we are carefully budgeting how much we can allocate to each service and how much each person will need. When we believe that we have completed our allocation, we will close off admission to the pilot.
Okay. All right. I'm very hopeful that it works. Well, so I just want to be clear that we understand the county and state responsibilities here.
Some of these things, for the chronic ones in Duluth, San Marco Apartments, within a year they had phenomenal data that it was working, and the police department in Duluth is very pleased they didn't have to arrest these people all the time.
Let's see here. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate those comments, and I think we've addressed, you know, those concerns, and I really appreciate that very much. Excited about the potential. And I do realize it is potential. That's, you know, the pilot. So the one thing I did like, though, was the pilot outcomes that are on your handout. And on the other hand, those are proposed outcomes you might track. And I think those are very good measurements. Mm-hmm. That would be very good. Do you expect that there will be these kinds of outcomes in the reports, such as on line 1.20, something very much like this will be the outcome? I don't want to tie you into it, but I think you might consider them as the future.
Well, and I think that speaks to what Cindy Rupp was referencing earlier. We don't know exactly where these savings will be. It might be in reduced criminal justice involvement. It might be in reduced hospitalizations. It might be in reduced mental health utilization, eventually. So we don't really know. But the way outcomes are typically looked at with cost benefit, it has been fairly narrow in the past. Government entities tend to look at what is the savings in their own silo, and we hope to do a broader based evaluation to see where our savings across the entire system. So I think that's promising as well.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, you know, again, in Duluth, it's basically run by a private operator, but it's county based, but the savings are showing up in the city of Duluth.
Exactly, Mr. Chairman, and I do see that. I just think that would be most helpful to document those as much as possible, and I liked your pilot outcomes, and I don't know if you're thinking of incorporating as in an amendment as you go on in the future, or if you just want to keep more flexibility or, you know, something like that, because I thought these were really good, and I really do like the more holistic approach, and I think they're intrinsic, plus the value to the client themselves at getting free of these things and living a better life, too. Thank you.
Okay, any further questions? I don't see any. So, you know, if we could, by the time we get to doing the budget bill, if you could get us sort of just an estimate of how much you think you're going to spend out of the CD fund on this particular proposal, I would appreciate that. And with that, Representative Liebling moves to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, John.
Let's see who's next. Representative Clark was here a minute ago.
I'm
here. Oh, there she is. Okay. First, she has two bills. First one is House File 1896. And I will move House File 1896 and ultimately be laid over. So, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have two bills before you, and they're related. And one of the things that I was listening with interest to the last bill, for part of it anyway, and one of the things that I'm trying to do with this, with these two bills, is to help provide the funding that is needed for our chemical dependency treatment, and also for some of the judicial costs that are related to alcohol and chemical dependency use and abuse. And so I have a couple witnesses with me. Let me just say that House File 1896 is a pretty simple bill. If I could just speak to both of them briefly, Mr. Chairman. Is that okay? Okay. So House File 1896 is pretty simple. We're basically saying there that we are going to establish an alcohol, health, and judicial impact fund. And into it, we are going to put the dollars that come from raising the fee, and we're calling it health and and judicial impact fee, a user fee, on alcoholic drinks. And this particular bill, 1896, is very progressive. If you looked at the numbers and what it is applied to, you would see that we get as low as 2 cents for a drink of certain kind of cheap beer to higher costs for more fancy drinks. And so this is the progressive bill, Mr. Chairman, for those of you who might be concerned about whether or not we're doing fees in an unprogressive way for alcohol. I want to point out that what we are doing in creating this new fund is to take half of the revenues that would be generated, so we're sharing with the general fund, but those revenues that are generated, half of them would be available to the Commissioners of Public Safety, Corrections, and Human Services, and these would be to then be available to local governments who can certify, would certify to the state that they have used and they need these fees to pay for their costs relating to the following: enforcing laws for driving while drinking, impaired law, law enforcement officers' costs, compliance checks, community policing, preventing domestic violence, incarceration of offenders who are driving drunk, paying the costs of those incarcerating those offenders, grants to counties to actually establish and operate probation, their probation programs related to these offenders, increasing the chemical dependency treatment programs both at our state prisons and in our communities, funding health and human service program costs, judicial training costs to help our judges understand how to use this law, and the court services, and also to fund education and crime prevention initiatives. And this is all done by a 2.5% gross receipts tax on retail sales of liquor sold in Minnesota. I'm not going to go into a whole lot more there except to say that what I want you to understand is we are talking about a user fee, and you're going to hear some very compelling testimony from the witnesses who will help us understand that this begins to pay for some of the incredible costs that are associated in our society, in our state, with alcohol and chemical abuse. The other bill, 2125, if I may just briefly turn to that, is a much more prescriptive bill. Senator Murphy works really hard on this one in particular, and it does also apply a fee to the cost of alcohol. And it is more prescriptive in that it requires assessments to be done in certain cases, including when there's a violent crime, including when there is evidence that there may be a chemical dependency problem. It provides for care coordination and really tries to get at some of the kind of services that I think we were hearing about a bit in the last bill. This has a different method of applying the fee, and you can see it laid out there. And if you want, I believe you might have in your folders maybe a chart that shows the difference between the two bills and how the fees work. This one also requires that there will be judicial training so that our judges will know how to use these chemical dependency assessment tools that we're providing for here. And Mr. Chairman, I think with that, what I'd really like to do is get to the heart of why we need this legislation, whichever one of the two ways we would do it here could be provided. So I'd like to ask a few witnesses to come forward. Mr. Melson first.
Good afternoon. My name is Bob Melson. I'm representing the March Association, as I said a minute ago, the Minnesota Association for Resources, Recovery, and Chemical Health. And we've been attempting to have all of you take a look at raising a fund or really raising the price of alcohol to the citizens of the state of Minnesota. And I say that kind of unabashedly because the marketplace works. We all know that raising the price of something decreases some of its consumption, especially to the most price-sensitive people. The research says those people are young people. The research says that the longer you can keep young people from abusing alcohol, the less likely they are to develop long-term alcohol problems in their lives. And maybe they won't need case management from county caseworkers 10 years from now. The alcohol excise tax is a true user fee. I'd like you all to think very briefly about how many six-packs of beer you have to buy in a week or how many you bring home. Maybe you shouldn't think about it. I don't know. But if you bring home one six-pack a week, it would be, at a dime a drink, approximately 60 cents. If you bring home 10 a week, it would be $6. Okay? If you're needing to buy a quart of some kind of hard liquor, it would be $3.20 per week or per month or per year, whatever it is. If you do more than that, then it would be more than that. But if you're drinking more, it's perfectly graduated by your own consumption. One time a friend of mine said, was a lot easier once I decided I didn't need to be drunk to do anything I wanted to do. Okay? That can be kind of an interesting thought, too. So 80% of the booze is drank by 20% of the people. 3 out of 4 Minnesotans support increasing the excise tax as long as it's used to pay for treatment and prevention and those kind of things that alcohol create problems in our society. The costs of alcohol use far exceed what we get back. Right now, I think in 2001, we collected $260 million. The cost was $4.5 billion. That results in $900 for every citizen of the state of Minnesota. The alcohol excise tax was last increased in 1987. It's not indexed for inflation whatsoever. So effectively, the price of alcohol compared to the price of bread and anything else that's got taxes on it has actually gone down. Other states have recently increased the alcohol user fee. It's being looked at all over the United States. A modest increase in the excise tax will generate funds to pay for the costs of alcohol and other drug use problems. Local governments, which is another issue, we met on the county pilot project, and my comment was, I understand that the counties are on the hook for dealing with a lot of these people. These costs do not only show up in treatment. They show up in detox, they show up in jail, they show up in prison, they show up in health care, and it's not likely that all of a sudden next Tuesday all these people are going to disappear. This has been going on for thousands and thousands of years. We don't understand very well what causes it. We don't understand very well why one person becomes chemically dependent and the other person doesn't after only brief episodes of use. But we don't understand why I've lived a fair share of my life on coffee and donuts and my wife eats vegetables and salads and she's diabetic. We don't understand that either, okay? So I think it's an important important thing that we need to take a look at this in these times of, somebody said shortages or something, and I said, yes, we have shortages aplenty. So anyway, thank you very much for listening to me.
I just have to comment, there's a recent study, unfortunately it's with rats, but if you have the equivalent of 5 cups of coffee a day, you don't get Alzheimer's if you're a rat.
Okay, I'll just take that under advisement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to have the next witness.
Can I just ask a quick question?
Oh,
Mr.
Sure.
Chair?
Yeah, Representative Keith.
So why do we call this a nickel? A drink?
No, I actually think there are two different bills here. One of them is progressive, and it goes way down as far as 2 cents a drink. The other one, I believe, is more closer to a dime a drink, and I'm not sure where the nickel...
Or a dime a drink? What's that based on?
It's based on taking a barrel of alcohol and figuring out what the tax is and then breaking it down into drinks. And they did it upstairs in-house research and our tax researchers.
So one... 31. Okay, so one can of beer is a dime per can of beer. That's considered a drink.
Under the one bill, yes, that's
yeah. Outstanding. The excise tax formula in Minnesota is quite complicated, to put it mildly, and because it's all of them are taxed at different rates. I'm sorry, I should have said, Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, but so it's a very complicated system and. That's kind of how it works out. And it's all collected. I should add there's almost no cost to the state of Minnesota because it basically is changing a formula.
And one other question, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Thiessen. Yeah.
Is, so on a, and maybe this varies by the type of alcohol, I suppose, if it change, varies, but so there actually is research that people are deterred by an extra 10 cents on a can of beer? Young people are.
Primarily, Representative Thiessen, Mr. Chairman, yes, primarily young people, people who are the most price sensitive, okay?
And is have those, Mr. Chair, have those studies shown that a dime is what gets people price sensitive? I mean, or is it just that as you raise prices, people are more price sensitive?
Representative Thiessen, my understanding is from, and I can't remember it exactly, but that as the price goes up, you cut more and more people out of the market or limit their access or their access for binge drinking when those things occur. I mean, if you've got $20 to spend and you can buy less beer, you will buy less beer.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Thank you.
Okay, next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Casagrande, and I am here as the Executive Director of Park Avenue Center and a representative of MARCH. Let me first start by saying that treatment works. Study after study proves it. Treated patients have been shown to reduce ER visits by 39%, hospital stays by 35%, and total medical costs by 26%. spending money on treatment was shown to reduce the likelihood of being arrested by 16% and reduce the likelihood of felony convictions by 34%. For every $100,000 spent on treatment, $487,000 of health care costs and an additional $700,000 of crime costs were shown to be avoided. In other words, for every $1 you spend on addiction treatment, $7 in crime and criminal justice costs are shown to be avoided. When researchers added the cost of health care, the savings to cost ratio became 12 to 1. In spite of this overwhelming evidence, the governor has punished substance abuse providers by consistently freezing rates and now proposing a 5% rate reduction. The effects of these rate freezes and cuts have been crippling. With that said, we fully understand and appreciate that we're in the middle of an economic crisis. House File 2125 and 1896 are a creative, proactive response to this crisis. As you've heard, alcohol costs Minnesota businesses, families, and taxpayers billions of dollars per year. It makes sense and it is fair that the negative effects of alcohol abuse and misuse are paid for by the users through a user fee. The alcohol fee has not been raised in 22 years, longer than almost any other tax that's on the books. And finally, I beg of you, do not support cuts to drug and alcohol treatment. To put it simply, we can't afford any more cuts. Thank you again for this opportunity and your time.
Go ahead.
My name is Larry Blair, and I'm the director for Fountain Centers. And I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time repeating stuff, but as Mark said, treatment does work. The one thing that we can do is be able to increase the people getting into treatment and having access to treatment and also funding for treatment. As we're able to do that, more people are going to get treatment and actually get reduced cost in other areas of society. And that's, like I said, I don't want to repeat a lot of the things that's been already said, but thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering, do we have a list of testifiers here today who are wanting to testify? I just wanted to be sure that we have one more for the bill as well. I was especially thinking it'd be important at this time that we hear from those who might be opposed to the bill and to be sure that we get a balanced perspective on this.
So we have one more on the agenda, and then we'll open it to anybody who wants to testify.
All right. Should I go?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm Carol Falkowski again, still director of the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division at the Department of Human Services. And I'm here not as a supporter or detractor of the bill. I'm here simply to point out that the reach of alcohol-related costs and substance abuse-related costs in government is far-reaching and not always readily apparent. In fact, most substance abuse-related spending is found hidden in departments and activities that don't bear the name of addiction or substance abuse in their title. And this is because untreated substance use disorders increase crime, threaten public safety, compromise parenting and child rearing, disrupt education and adolescent development, impair the ability to engage in steady employment, and place increased demands on the healthcare system. The costs of untreated addiction on the healthcare system appear through preventable accidents, homicides, domestic violence, child abuse, sexual assaults, unplanned pregnancies, birth defects, and more than 70 substance abuse-related illnesses that can require hospitalization. Substance abuse in the workplace is associated with lower productivity, increased turnover in workplace accidents, and higher health insurance costs. In fact, up to a quarter of employees report being subject to an injury or almost being injured at work or redoing work of a coworker because of their coworker's alcohol use. So that the reach of alcohol-related costs in government extends beyond just what hits the surface. Therefore, I wanted to clarify that the fiscal note that the Department of Human Services prepared for this bill or the other one, I'm not sure, is limited to just the spending on treatment and just the spending from the CSSA fund for detox. But I do want to point out, and it should have been handed out to you, a study that was done by the Center for Alcohol and Substance Abuse at Columbia University called Shoveling Up the Impact of Substance Abuse on Federal, State, and Local Governments. And using its methodology for all 50 states, it found that the state spending on substance abuse and addiction in 2005 in the state of Minnesota to be $2.8 billion spread across child welfare, corrections, judiciary, health, child welfare, income assistance, mental health, developmental disabilities. So that's what I'm here to point out, that it's quite huge. And both this report by the Center for Alcohol and Substance Abuse at Columbia that is headed by Joe Califano, former Secretary of Health and Human Services under Jimmy Carter, and this joined together blueprint for states that was put together in 06 by the Boston University School of Public Health, talk about different strategies for states to help bear the burden of the cost. And both of these reports talk about tax structure as one strategy for doing that. Finally, if you don't have this, it was distributed, so you would get this from, yeah, good, you have it. What that points out is that state governments spend about 16% of their budget to deal with substance abuse, and if substance abuse and addiction were its own state budget category, it would rank second behind spending for elementary and secondary education. And that states spend more on substance abuse and addiction than they spend on Medicaid, higher education, transportation, or justice. But it's spread out, and it's not always in one place. So that's the only point I'm trying to submit for your consideration as you look at different strategies to try to address this.
Hey, Representative Broad.
I just had a question, Mr. Chairman, related to that 16% statistic that you just quoted. I'm curious how much of that 16% is actually attributed to beer and wine, and how much of that 16% is attributed to illicit drugs or other drugs that are not legal drugs, and actually smoking as well.
That's a good point. I'm not aware of the specifics of their methodology, but they did look, the CASA one did look at all of those factors. That said, I am aware that Minnesota has historically been and currently is one of the heaviest drinking states in the country when you look at drinking, both binge drinking and just the percent of the population who drinks at all.
And we're beaten by Wisconsin, however.
Yep.
And they would love to point that out to you.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be interested in seeing if there's a way to break that down, because if you're going to use that number as a policy, as a reason to enact a policy that is actually going to hit only a portion of that, I think that that's information that is useful to all of us. This bill really doesn't get at, I think, probably a big portion of that 16% that you're quoting, and I would like to see a breakdown of that. I think that would be helpful, at least to me.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Thiessen, then we're going to go to let other people testify.
Good. Okay, well, I guess my questions are for the author and how this ended up in finance immediately. I don't think, it didn't go to our policy committee, I know that, and I don't know if it went to any other policy committees. And we have two bills before us right now, is that right?
Two bills, we haven't moved the second one, but I'll do that, and they're going to be laid over for unless you think they should go someplace else.
Well, I don't know. There's a lot of stuff in these bills that are policy questions, it seems to me. And there's two taxes. There's a retail tax being imposed and this wholesale fee imposed.
Gross reset, resale. And
what?
Yes, gross receipts tax. And
is there two taxes?
Size tax.
I mean, is someone double taxed at some point?
Two different ways to collect a tax on one product that causes a lot of costs to us, yes.
And my only question is, is it because there's two different streams, so they'd be only taxed once in the different streams, or is some things that go through the wholesale and then taxed again at the retail level, and some things just taxed at the liquor store?
This does not have a wholesale tax.
Okay, so it's liquor store versus in a bar.
Yes, on and off sale.
Mm-hmm. Okay. and that's probably for tax committee, but do you know why this went right to finance?
Well, I think, I guess it was a discussion with the chair of the committee, and it seems like what we're mostly talking about here is trying to deal with funding that the state desperately needs, that our counties desperately need to deal with the costs. And we've looked at these issues before. This is not a new bill. I think I've probably had this bill for maybe the last 10 or 12 years. And the thing that might be a little different, and especially on 1896, is that we're trying to make sure that there is an actual fund that's available that can be tapped by our counties and tapped by our state government. And we're doing a kind of a progressive kind of look at how to tax the alcohol products. And the other one, it's not as progressive, but in both cases, they're very small amounts attached to each drink.
And Mr. Chair, I'll leave it at that. I mean, 1896 does look like it's pretty much a pure funding kind of bill. The other one, I guess, is the one that looked like it had a lot more to it. And
mm-hmm,
so
it does.
Maybe we can leave it at that, though.
Okay. Well, we have two more people that want questions, but first we're going to hear from any opponents. I see at least one.
I think we have a page. There he is. Can I have one?
Who made that?
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Bagnoli. I'm with the law firm McGrann Shea. I'm here today represent the Minnesota Licensed Beverage Association and the Municipal Beverage Association as well. But I come to you today representing a coalition of folks, a letter of which is being passed out. You'll recognize them as mostly providers of either producers or providers or people who move, as in the case of the Teamsters, who move alcoholic beverages. And we're here today to oppose both of these bills, surprisingly. I just want to point out that this is a legal product that is, when used properly, has no negative health benefits. It's important to understand, when used properly, has no negative health detriments. Excuse me. In fact, you got what I was trying to go. I think you understood what I was trying to say. I had to say it twice and screw it up the second time to really sink it into you.
This is value-added. You relieved our board.
Thank you. And in fact, I think there's been some evidence that I'm not equipped to comment on tremendously, but that I think we all know that there's some suggestion that a glass of wine, when used responsibly, that actually it can have healthful, salutary benefits to your health. I'm in the health committee. I think that's important to note. I also think that what we're talking about here is the misuse of the product, the implications and the harm that can come from the misuse of the product. And we're talking about singling out one product for the misuse by a very, very small group of folks. Cars are misused. Food is misused that leads to a lot of health implications. People who eat too many calories, wrong kinds of food, that can lead to health impacts. Firearms can be misused. Small group of people misusing any one of these products leads to harm. For some reason, alcohol, and I'm aware that there is polling that has been done on this that suggests that this is a place that people go to easily, is being singled out for this. And it's being singled out by this sheet that was distributed that shows, I mean, I think one of the gentlemen said $4 billion, I think, and I appreciate the person from the Department of Health or Human Services not taking a position but suggesting that there was still, I think, $3 or $4 or $5, I don't know what, $1 billion. This one suggests $2.8 billion. Just so you know, I went up, this is a 2005, I checked with Bill Marks just before committee. In 2005, the entire public safety article that the House that was adopted by legislature was $762 million. The entire Representative Paymar's entire bill was $762 million. So I would just suggest that these numbers, I don't have any idea from where they're drawn from. And I'm not suggesting that the misuse of alcohol doesn't have health impacts. But I'm just suggesting that the numbers that you're being quoted are wildly, grossly, obviously inflated. Finally, I would also suggest that we are uniquely taxed. I wish Representative Thiessen was here. We are paying currently, actually last year in 2008, or not last year, the year before in 2008, all the combined taxes that were paid by alcohol were $300 million per year. It's such a large number that it's a line item in the tax committee. It's one of the largest, if not the largest, single item that's taxed in the state. It is the most uniquely taxed product in the state of Minnesota. So I wish Representative Thiessen was here. There are three products that have excise taxes that are taxed at the wholesale level. One of those products is taxed at the retail level. Three products. Liquor, or alcohol, I should say. Alcohol. Gasoline. And cigarettes. Three products that are taxed at the wholesale level. Of those products, only one is taxed at the retail level, alcohol. Gasoline, there's no sales tax on gasoline at the pump. You pay the excise tax. That's why 2 or 3 years ago the argument was, we haven't raised it in 20 years or whatever the years was. We need to raise it. We're losing ground to inflation. Which was factually true. You were losing ground to inflation because there was no sales tax at the pump. Unlike that, alcohol has sales tax on it. More uniquely, there are two products in the state of Minnesota that have a sales tax, the state sales tax, which is 6.875 right now, plus an additional 2.5% gross receipts tax. Two products, alcohol and rental cars. So alcohol is the lone product that is taxed at the excise tax with an excise tax at the wholesale level. So when you raise it at the wholesale level, the sales tax is put on again at 9.375, which is the only product that is taxed excise and then with the sales plus the gross receipts. It's singular. We are the most taxed product in the state. We are substantially less than our surrounding states. And I know that for those who view Wisconsin in a negative light because their alcohol is taxed perhaps so little.
Don't look at me.
Well.
Oh, you're looking at her. Okay.
In any case, for those who look at it as a negative light because it's taxed so little, increasing the taxes on alcohol in Minnesota will potentially cause people to go across the river. Additionally, the place where it will be, the suggestion is that we do 3.3 cents at the excise tax. That trickles up to the sales tax level of 9%. At the bar restaurant level, the ability to absorb the elasticity that they have couldn't be worse right now to absorb increases. They would tell you, if they were here, they have absorbed in the last couple of years a smoking ban increase, which has very clear and evident health benefits to many, but it has an enormously affected bar owners and places like bars, other retail establishments. They've had 0.08 go into effect, which has affected. It may have other benefits, but it has no doubt had an impact on bars and restaurants. They have had the minimum wage go up three times in the last 3 years. There's very few places where people's wages are going up. Simultaneous to all of that is the worst economic conditions in the last 40 years. People are going out less. People are going to bars and restaurants less. All that coupled together creates an environment where any additional increase, and an additional increase, it's not a bartender doesn't or a restaurant doesn't add 3 pennies. To a tab, or 5 cents, or what I think it's more like 18 or 20 cents to a tab. It goes up in increments. And there's only so much, as I say, there's only so much money that people will go out and buy a beer, have a beer and a burger at a restaurant with their family. They just, there's a point where people say it's too expensive, I won't go home. This is a real threat to bar owners and restaurant owners in the state. So with that, I understand that in the coming weeks and months and perhaps next year as well, that there's going to be some desire on the part of some to look at raising alcohol taxes under what I believe is a false idea. I want to say one more thing about this claim. It hasn't been raised since 1987. That's true. That tax hasn't been raised since 1987 on the excise tax. On the sales tax, it was scheduled to blink off in the 2001 tax provisions that some of you were around that adopted. It was scheduled to go away. It was on the sales tax side, it was scheduled to go from 9% to 6.5% to be streamlined. Next year there was a budget problem and that blink off was taken away. So arguably from our position, the tax has gone up or increased. It's also increased. We're at 9%. I don't know of any other products whose tax hasn't been increased. I mean, many projects have never even had an excise tax, so the tax hasn't been increased. All the people with the sales tax, it's been the same as well. We feel we're being singled out. We know that there's other folks, that there's some sense on the part of folks in the future, now and in the future, that we're going to need revenue and we might need to raise revenue. And we don't want to be singled out. That's all of my testimony, and I encourage you to drink responsibly. It's healthy for you.
We're going to have time for one brief question, and we're out of time. Representative Gottwald. Pepin was first.
I'll pass.
Okay, Representative Gottwald.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll try to make this quick. I had so many issues with this that I'll try to pick and choose here. First of all, we've got a policy bill in a finance committee after deadline. Most of this is advisory to you, I understand, since this is laid over for possible inclusion, but we're creating two taxes on Joe Sixpack. I mean, these are job-killing tax increases, but I want to point members on the committee to the language in the bill. There's so many other things I could touch on, but I want to talk about lines 1.20 through 1.24. That language reads, the costs of fighting alcohol abuse should be funded by those who abuse alcohol, period. Consequently, the legislature is increasing the tax on the sale of alcohol to fund aggressive efforts to reduce impaired driving offenses and generally prevent crime, injury, and loss of life. So the premise of the bill is that we're going to tax everybody who drinks alcohol, whether they do it responsibly or irresponsibly, because this should be funded by those who abuse alcohol. Mr. Chair, I would submit that that's a faulty premise on which to base legislation, and I think we've heard some testimony to that effect, but I'll leave it at that.
Representative Broaden, got to be really short.
I just have a quick procedural point or question. Mr. Chairman, there's actually two bills before us, but there's a third bill out there, from my understanding, which is a Wagenius bill, House File 3296. Now, what's interesting about this is that House File 1896, Representative Clark's bill, was referred to the Committee on Finance, and Representative Wagenius's bill does something very similar, and that was referred on March 1st, 2010, on the Committee on Taxes. And then Representative Clark's other bill, House File 2125, was referred to the Committee on Public Safety, Policy, and Oversight. And so I'm concerned about the consistency out there related to these three bills, which do very similar things, and whether they're actually walking through the process in the appropriate way. These are very significant, not only policy but finance decisions. All of them are very similar in approach and should probably be in the same place to be considered, so we can look at the differences between them. So, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm concerned about the process. I'm concerned about where all these bills are going to be fitting in terms of the puzzle that's put together down the road. I guess I'm not sure if there's motions that need to be made on the floor to move them around and get them in the right place, but I just wanted to bring that to your attention. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity.
Okay. They were sent here because I have oversight over, or we have oversight over the Chemical Dependency Fund, where
much of this is discussed. But we have to finish, so I would move House File 1896 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
So that's been laid over. And then I would move House File 2125 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
So both of those are laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Bart,
any members.
And we have the minutes, let's see, of the March 11th meeting. Would somebody like to move those minutes? Representative Fritz moves the minutes from March 11th. And all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? None. And there will be no meeting tonight.
Oh, no meeting.
Okay, so no meeting tonight.
There we go.
And probably not the next two nights either, even though they were scheduled. So with that, the meeting is adjourned.